Good evening, everyone. My name is Denisa Kostovicheva, and I'm an associate professor in the European Institute. I would like to welcome you all to the LSE and tonight's discussion, which is going to be on the topic of peace, which is paradoxically a topic. Peace is a concept and something that we almost take for granted. And when we talk about post-conflict contexts and post-conflict recovery, very little understood, because most of the research that goes on in conflict and peace studies is actually focused on conflict. So it is the publication of this book, which is called Measuring Peace, that addresses this gap by tonight's speaker, Professor Richard Kaplan, that gives us this opportunity to actually begin to unpack how we understand peace and to use the language that Richard uses in this book. How do we understand and how do we know stable peace? Richard Kaplan is professor of international relations and official fellow of Lineker College at the University of Oxford. His latest book, Measuring Peace, is just a last book in a series of books that he's published focusing on different facets of post-conflict reconstruction and also on the involvement of external actors in assisting transition from war to peace. He's written about Europe's new nationalism, States and Minorities in Conflict. That book was followed by another one called Europe and Recognition of New States in Yugoslavia, and a perspective where he kind of develops our understanding of what is required to reconstruct post-conflict societies and to understand the role of external actors in this process is international governance of war-torn territories. Richard will speak first, but I'm absolutely delighted that Professor Mary Calder is also joining us tonight. And I'm particularly looking forward to her comments because she too has conducted pioneering research in issues that have to do with conflict, with democratization, and with globalization. And I think the perspective that she's taken that starts from deep understanding of contemporary conflicts and violence in the global context and how this then impacts on trying to build peace afterwards will be particularly interesting. Professor Calder has also had a powerful impact on policymaking, drawing on this theoretical and empirical understanding of conflict and what is required for peace building. Specifically, and I had the pleasure to work with her on the security, human security doctrine for Europe, which was done on the invitation on the day of the then EU policy chief, Javier Solana. There is a very, very long list of titles to Mary's name, but for just sort of the relevance of tonight's discussion, I'll mention her seminal work on new and old wars, organized violence in the global era. Another book is Global Civil Society, An Answer to War and Human Security. And most recently, she has co-authored the book on law and new wars. I'm very much look forward to their exchange of views, but what we'll do is we'll leave some time for a broader discussion and invite questions for the audience. And just before I hand over to Richard, I would like to give a nice warm LSE welcome to our speakers.
Denisa, thank you very much. It's a very great pleasure to be here at the LSE, and I'm very pleased to see so much interest in this topic. Doesn't surprise me. LSE has a long tradition of research in the area, some of the questions that I'll be talking about tonight. The lecture has been titled, How Can Peace Be Measured? And what I would like to do is to approach this question by way of another question. And that question is the following. How do we know that the peace that's been established following a civil war is a stable peace? And it's an important question for a number of reasons, many of which I expect you will be familiar with, but I'll mention nonetheless. The first is the vulnerability of conflict-affected states to conflict relapse. Now, with a colleague of mine, Anke Heffler, we looked at all internal conflicts, that is, all civil wars, that ended in or after 1990 until 2013, so the majority of the post-Cold War period to date. And we looked at how long the peace after those civil wars endured. And for purposes of this analysis, a peace spell is marked by the end of armed conflict, however it might be achieved, a military victory, a ceasefire, a negotiated settlement, or just a fizzling out of armed conflict, provided that it lasts for a year. That's what constitutes a peace episode for purposes of this analysis. And in that period, we found that there were 210 peace spells. Now, by that, I don't mean that there were 210 civil wars that came to an end, because civil wars can start, stop, and start again. And that's what we were looking at, as I said, were these peace episodes, provided that they lasted for at least a year. And this chart, which you see on the screen now, depicts how many and how quickly, if you will, peace breaks down in this period among these peace episodes. In fact, effectively, it shows how long peace survives as measured in days, which is the axis along the bottom there. And in the beginning, as you'd expect, peace holds for a period of time, actually for about 2 years. After 2 years, 99% of all peace episodes, of pieces, if you will, remain intact. And then after 3 years, 83% of these peace spells have survived, so still a relatively large number of them. But after 12 years, only about half of all peace spells have survived. So that's a very high rate, if you will, of peace failure. Indeed, if you were to extend the timeline from 1946 to 2013 and take into consideration all conflict-affected states in that period, you'd find that 105 countries suffered a civil war during that time. And of those 105 countries, more than half, 59 countries precisely, experienced a relapse into violent conflict, in some cases more than once, after peace had been established. So that's one reason why peace stability matters, the high rate of conflict relapse or conflict recidivism. Now, another reason is the cost of peacekeeping and peace building and associated activities. This chart shows just UN expenditure on peacekeeping in the period 1950 to 2013. If you were to extend that graph to the present, you would see a slight downturn in the current fiscal year, the year ending in the end of June 2019. Spending on peacekeeping operations at the UN was about $6.7 billion, but still quite significant. And bear in mind that this is for UN peacekeeping only. It doesn't reflect other efforts at the United Nations to consolidate peace. It doesn't reflect the work of donor states, which is quite considerable, towards peace consolidation, and it doesn't reflect the work of other organizations, either multilateral or, for that matter, non-governmental. Indeed, if you look at this chart, you can see the number of regional peace organizations, that is, non-UN operations, in the period from, again, 1946 to 13. Regional organizations, especially in Africa and in Europe, have taken on more and more responsibility for peacekeeping and for peace consolidation. You can see a very significant rise in the number of operations. So peace operations expenditure is another reason why peace stability matters. And then finally, recall that the United Nations established in 2005 a Peace Building Commission, PBC, whose purpose was to focus on countries emerging from violent conflict, bearing in mind what I said earlier about the high rate of conflict recidivism, the high rate of conflict relapse. There was a recognition that countries in conflict, if they're can get a lot of attention. Once the conflict subsides or ends, and at this very critical moment when countries are still very, very fragile, international attention tends to shift. And it was thought that this is one reason why we see this tendency towards relapse. So the Peacebuilding Commission was established in 2005 at that same World Summit which brought us the responsibility to protect norm. But the challenge that the Peacebuilding Commission has is, when does a country graduate? When does a country come off the agenda of the Peacebuilding Commission? And this is a genuine concern, by the way. Within the United Nations, this is something which they are actively concerned with. Now, we do have an answer to that, in a way. This is the enabling resolution, UN Security Council Resolution 1645, that established the Peacebuilding Commission. And it tells us that the Commission shall terminate its consideration of a country-specific situation for two reasons. The second is just at the request of the national authorities. They no longer wish to be on the agenda. But the first is when the foundations for sustainable peace and development are established. But the problem is that this only begs the question, because when are the foundations for sustainable peace and development established? And the problem is that we don't have hard measures of a consolidated peace, in contrast, say, to the indicators we might have of a prosperous economy, notably certain macroeconomic fundamentals, or a healthy population, immunization rates or literacy rates, for instance. Contentious though some of these indicators may be, you may be aware that there's quite a lot of debate around the utility of, for instance, GDP growth as a measure of economic prosperity. But nonetheless, even if we put that conventional measure aside, there are other hard indicators that give us some insight into prosperity and into the health of a country, of a population. But we don't really have that for peace, I would say, and that is part of the problem. Now, you could say, well, what about the absence of armed conflict? That's a good indicator if a country is at peace. But I'd say that that's really only symptomatic of a stable peace. It's not itself an indicator. So there are various ways that we can approach this question of how can we know if peace is a stable peace? And one way is to identify the factors that are known by scholars to be responsible for the onset of conflict, and then to ask ourselves, are these factors present in the case in question? So scholars have identified, and this is highly, if you will, simplified, scholars have identified three broad classes of causes of conflict. And the first is motivation. You may be familiar with some of these authors associated with this approach. Motivation encompasses a very wide range of often grievance-based sub-factors. Relative deprivation, horizontal inequalities, ethnic insecurity, just to focus on a few. The second factor is feasibility, another approach that's taken, which stresses more opportunity than motivation. suggesting, for instance, that rebellion is more likely to occur when material conditions favor it. If there's mountainous terrain, if there are natural resources for, let's say, rebels to exploit. And the third broad class of causes is what you might call lack of resilience, which emphasizes the vulnerability of states to various internal and external pressures. For instance, rising food prices, migration. You think about the situation Syria, Jordan, at the moment under enormous pressure, other countries in that region, and the capacity of states to cope effectively with these pressures. Now, there are two problems with this approach, at least two problems. One, and this probably won't surprise you, is that there's no consensus among scholars as to which causal factors matter or which matter most. If you read Charles Cole's very excellent book, Why Peace Fails, he writes, and I'm quoting now, that there's a tremendous disparity among scholars about whether certain factors are important or not, and about the degree to which they're important. But the other reason why this approach is problematic is that it assumes that the causes of conflict are the same as the causes of conflict recurrence. And that isn't always the case. There are factors in common. Chuck Cole, again, with his quantitative analysis, shows us that there are certain risk factors that are shared between conflict onset and conflict recurrence: political instability, population size, reliance on natural resources, notably oil. But wars are transformative. So the factors that give rise to a conflict in the first instance are not necessarily going to be the same factors that explain the recurrence. The root causes of a conflict, for instance, may no longer pertain, precisely because of the changes that the conflict itself has wrought. There may be population displacements or the rise of new political elites. I mean, think about the civil war in Afghanistan from 1989 to 1992, which facilitated the rise of fundamentalist Islam forces that in turn provoked a new civil war from 1992. Okay, so that's one approach, focusing, as I said, on the causes of conflict onset. Another approach looks not at the causes of civil war, but the causes of peace in the aftermath of war. So what measures have been most successful in maintaining the peace after violent conflict, and have they been applied to these cases in question? And again, the range of possibilities, the differences among scholars is considerable. Scholars have focused on the nature of war termination, whether it has ended in a military victory versus a negotiated settlement, a military victory considered to contribute to a more stable outcome. They've also focused on third-party guarantees, whether, for instance, there are UN peacekeepers, NATO stabilization forces, signatories to a treaty who commit to the implementation of this treaty, for instance. And then the nature of the political settlement. For instance, how representative is it? How inclusive is it? I mean, this is very much the current focus, I would say, inclusivity in dealing with shaping the peace that is hoping to contribute to a lasting peace. Shaping the settlement. So none of the approaches, however, that I've been talking about are concerned really with the quality of the peace that's been established. And there is recognition, however, among scholars at least, of the importance of monitoring the quality of the peace and the progress of peace consolidation. And here's one example, Adrian Gwelk. Monitoring the progress of peace, he writes, is of such obvious value in any post-conflict society that the worth of doing so is rarely, if ever, challenged. However, the means used to do so is another matter. But how do the major peace-building actors, the organizations that are responsible for building peace, how do they assess progress towards the achievement of a consolidated peace? And how do they know whether the peace that they're working to establish is a self-sustaining peace? And the fact is, they don't often. They don't monitor progress, or they don't do it well enough. And I want to talk briefly about what they do. Before I do that, though, I do want to just say that it is very difficult to generalize about practices across time, across organizations. They, of course, change. And also, there will be always notable exceptions. Indeed, I'm going to highlight some of them after this discussion. There'll be notable exceptions to the generalizations that I'm making. But despite those caveats, I do think that the observations that I'm making here are, by and large, valid ones. And to begin with, rarely are the peace-building organizations themselves actually tasked with assessing the robustness of the peace that they're helping to build. It's what I call strategic assessment in the book. They don't undertake a broad assessment of the quality of the robustness of the peace that they're building. What often they do is to report on developments, and this is what you see here, a typical report of the Secretary General on a peacekeeping operation, in this case East Timor. And what these reports often contain are a discussion of the situation on the ground, an overview of developments since the last report, an evaluation of progress in the implementation of the mandate of the operation, and a discussion of the key challenges that are facing that operation. Reporting tends to be ad hoc and impressionistic. I spoke with lots of former special representatives to the Secretary General. They told me that the UN Secretariat lacks a uniform understanding of the purpose of a field report and a Security Council briefing, and they're given very little guidance in how to prepare these. There's a tendency to measure what's easily measurable. So, for instance, measuring how many police officers, local police officers, have undergone training in human rights, rather than assessing how human rights respectful police officers are or judges may be, which of course is what really counts, because it's only in seeing the behavior in the field that we're able to assess the quality of the peace that's being established, it's being lived. And then there's also a focus, a tendency to focus on mandate implementation. Now this makes a lot of sense, because these operations, after all, are established by organizations, the UN and others, and they have a mandate. They're answerable to the authorities that establish them. But as we know, mandates may not reflect the requirements for achieving a sustainable peace, and mandates are often the result of political compromise. And sometimes they will reflect the least common denominator, let's say, among members of the UN Security Council. So it's really what the Security Council will accept at a minimum, but it doesn't add up necessarily to satisfying the requirements for peace. And finally, the approach that a lot of organizations take is very partial. And this is actually the flip side of a good thing, meaning that a lot of peace building has become multilateral. Lots of different, as I indicated earlier, organizations, donor states involved, and that's good. I mean, it's good that it's not the province of just one country, let's say, in a kind of neo-colonial fashion. But the difficulty with that is that there's a tendency to just focus on that bit of the operation that a given country is responsible for. So thinking about Afghanistan, Germany's responsibility for training police, Italy's responsibility for reform of the justice system, and they lose sight as a consequence of the larger picture very often. So I did say that there are notable exceptions, and I just want to highlight some of these quickly. So one of them is the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which in 2008, by its own admission, was caught off guard by the Georgia-Russia crisis. And as a consequence, in a number of years later, 2012 and 13, the OSCE developed internal guidelines for early warning, allowing for a much more systematic and structured approach to the identification of potential conflicts and crisis situations. And they rolled out a conflict analysis toolkit and a set of early warning indicators for the organization's field operations, for each one of their field operations. And this toolkit and these indicators together, they provide a framework for the systematic analysis of conflict settings at the local, regional, national, and international levels, including, but not limited to, the assessments of the robustness or fragility of peace in the aftermath of violent conflict. And they take into consideration also relevant contextual issues, socioeconomic conditions, political conditions. So very, very broad, comprehensive. And by the OSCE's own reckoning, in the first year since the introduction of this framework, the OSCE Secretary General raised concerns about what he called worrying developments that threatened the peace from this analysis on 11 distinct occasions. And this was with respect, of course, to the OSCE region. And one of them in particular was Macedonia on the eve, you may remember, December 2016, elections that looked like they were going to lead to an outbreak of violence. And the OSCE was able to feed this analysis into the European Commission, and the European Commission was unusually outspoken in its criticism of a state in its neighborhood. And arguably this had a very significant effect on the ruling party and the political elites. And by contrast, if you look at the United Nations engagement in East Timor, there was a very interesting study that was done by somebody from the International Committee of Red Cross, who looked at the extent to which the United Nations relied on conflict analysis in its work. It was very extensively involved in East Timor, including a transitional administration, and he found that there was no prior conflict analysis. It was not a part of the standard operating procedure of the United Nations in the field. And they, too, were caught off guard by an eruption of violence in 2006. So early warning is one example of good practice. Let's see if, excellent, okay. And the other one I'll mention, and I'm not gonna go into discussion about all the others, is benchmarking within the United Nations. Now, benchmarking is a form, as you know, of evaluation that uses specified standards, a value, a process, a state of affairs, the attainment of which is thought to contribute to the realization of an operation's broad objective. So, for instance, the reduction and the elimination of militia threats may be a benchmark for the establishment of a secure environment. And if done properly, benchmarking can introduce a degree of rigor and precision into assessments that allow for monitoring towards achieving a stable peace. And this the United Nations has done on a number of occasions. Indeed, the first was in Sierra Leone going back quite a way to October 1999, where the UN set up in October 1999 a UNAMSIL, a peacekeeping operation after an 8-year civil war there. And when it was a question of at what point should the UN draw down and ultimately withdraw, they drew up a set of benchmarks. This is the first time that benchmarks were used to guide a UN peacekeeping operation towards drawdown and closure. And one of them included this first, building up the capacity of the Sierra Leone police and army, building it up to maintain external and internal security without international assistance, which I would say is a reasonable standard for a sustainable peace. And what the UN did was that it monitored province by province the police and the other armed forces to assess the readiness and the capacity of the government security forces to maintain peace and security. And that very, very rigorous assessment revealed a lot about the fitness of the country to look after its own security. So I won't, as I said, go into the others. You'll have to read the book. I know you're going to hear that at some point, of course, in the course of this lecture. But there are more discussions. It's always nice, too, we as scholars can be so critical. And it is nice when you can also highlight good practice. And as I said, there is a discussion throughout the book of good practices as well. So just to close, I want to highlight a few, if I'm allowed to move on, yes, of principles of good practice, which I discuss in the book. And the first of them, this is not exhaustive, but these are some of the key ones, is what I call an ethnographic approach. Now, you may be familiar with this term if you've read Severine Althusser's book, Peaceland, another book I strongly recommend, but she uses ethnographic approach in a different way to describe the way that she embedded herself in peace-building organizations to understand the culture, the thinking, the practices of those organizations. And I use it in the book for purposes of strategic assessment to emphasize the importance of greater reliance on knowledge of local culture, local history, and especially the particular conflict dynamics at work in that situation. Others have highlighted the importance, underscored the importance. If you have read Rory Stewart's book with Gerald Knaus, Can Intervention Work? He talks about the lack of local knowledge on the part of international personnel in Afghanistan and what he calls a central cause of the humiliating mess in Afghanistan, this lack of local knowledge. And earlier, Robert McNamara, the former U.S. Secretary of Defense and the chief architect for the Vietnam War, in his memoirs, he would, in a major mea culpa, bemoan what he called our profound ignorance of the history, culture, and politics of the people on the area. And if any of you have seen that brilliant documentary series by Nick Burns on Vietnam, you'll see how mistaken, misguided Americans were in Vietnam, convinced that what they were doing was countering a communist, a worldwide communist crusade, and not appreciating sufficiently that this was a struggle of national liberation at its heart. So profound ignorance of local culture, but especially the dynamics of the conflict, local dynamics of the conflict. So that's one principle. Another is the importance of continual strategic reassessment. And this is really important because conditions on the ground change. And so we peacebuilding organizations have to ask themselves, do the original objectives still support the broad strategic goal of the operation, have new or unanticipated impediments to a stable peace emerge? Are there, for instance, new external security challenges? Are there inauspicious political shifts within the country that would require maybe the articulation of new or altered objectives? Has available implementing capacity changed, either internationally or nationally? And what implications does this have for meeting an operations objective? So the importance of continually reassessing, not assuming that the guidance, the approach that we took at the outset is necessarily still valid. It requires a constant reflection on whether course adjustment is required. And then finally, and this is easier said than done, the incorporation of local perspectives. We often fail to take into consideration sufficiently what the conflict-affected population itself understands to be important, understands to be necessary for achieving a lasting peace. Now, I say easier said than done because conflict situations are often the result of and leave in their wake polarized communities. So it's very difficult to talk about a single, unnecessarily common view about what the requirements of peace might be. I mean, on any number of issues, take justice, whether we should forget and forgive or whether we should prosecute, it's very, very difficult to generalize for a population. There are going to be often divided views. But there are various ways, and again, another book I can recommend to you is Pamina Furtsho's book on everyday peace indicators, where she looked at the wishes, the desiderata of conflict-affected communities in Colombia and Uganda, and came up with some very surprising findings about how their views were at odds with what international peace builders working to support peace building in those communities assumed to be necessary. I mean, just one example was the provision of compensation to victims of the war, which led to a lot of resentment within the community on the part of those who received, who was a victim. That opened up all kinds of questions about visible, invisible forms of suffering and so forth. And this was something that the international community was not sufficiently sensitive to. So just to conclude, I just want to emphasize that strategic assessment is not merely a technical exercise. There is scope for thinking about so-called technical requirements, and I think that scholars have contributed to this in important ways. So just to give you an example, the whole question about the sequencing of the delivery of aid or the sequencing of the holding of elections, I think that there's been a lot of interesting work done by scholars of a comparative nature, and we can learn from those experiences. We always have to, again, be sensitive to the outlier and recognize that not every state is going to conform to the general patterns that scholars may find. But I don't think, and notwithstanding everything I said about the importance of being sensitive to local conditions, I don't think we should throw all kinds of large N and broad comparative analyses out the window. We just have to be careful about the conclusions that we draw about the generalizability. And the other thing is, let's be modest. The reference to bounded rationality, conflict is a highly complex social phenomenon. And it's very, very difficult, very easy with hindsight, not even always easy, but easier often with hindsight to appreciate what's been at work in a conflict. In the midst of it, it's often very difficult to understand all aspects of it anyway, precisely. Again, I don't want to suggest that these are impervious to reason. I think that that's often been used by policymakers as an excuse for inaction or an excuse for not taking particular actions because, oh, it's just so complicated and very, very difficult to understand how to engage effectively. But at the same time, I think we do have to be humble about what we can know. And then the other thing is, despite everything we might know, there are forces that are greater than knowledge at work, and politics is certainly one of them, and politics will often trump all other considerations. So when, just to give an example, the Chinese decided not to renew the peacekeeping mandate in Macedonia, it wasn't because they appreciated that a stable peace was in place. It was because of unhappiness about Macedonian relations with Taiwan. There are other occasions, countless other occasions, where political and budgetary considerations prevailed over what one might have thought would be the sensible thing to do. So we have to recognize, these ultimately, we operate, these operations take place in a political environment, and politics is often stronger than a sound knowledge that we might have. So that is really what I wanted to tell you. I'm focused on certain aspects of the book. As said, I encourage you to pick it up and read it for yourself, and if you do, I hope you find it of value. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Richard. Mary?
Well, I really appreciate the careful work that Richard has done in trying to unpack the various complexities of contemporary peace. And I agree with him very much about the need for ethnographic, vernacular, local understandings of what's going on. Although when we talk about what's local, we should be aware that the local is never truly local. And I have to say that when I hear Rory Stewart being quoted, he has a very romantic view of what one might call Orientalist view of sort of tribal and elders and how they could really run the country, whereas many of the tribal elders that he meets are sort of artificially created people who've been studying in the Gulf at Islamic schools. And so globalization is a phenomenon that appears at very, very local levels. But I wanted to address a bigger question relating to the meaning of peace, and that actually relates to the meaning of conflict. Because to tell you the truth, thinking about this, I find it very difficult to think of a single case where contemporary conflict, I would say since the end of the 80s, has actually ended. Sierra Leone's not bad, I think, and I love to tell you, I had to evaluate the UN in Sierra Leone, so I've got some nice stories about that. Bosnia is not bad, but it's a really dysfunctional society, and it's had more money per head than in martial aid to Western Europe and more troops, and we couldn't afford to do that everywhere. But I really don't know any cases where you could say that peace came. And I was thinking when you began about saying, did armed conflict revive? I mean, the problem is that our measures of armed conflict are based on numbers of battle deaths. And as you say yourself, there's other sorts of violence. So it may be the case that when there are actual clashes between armed groups don't exist, but most of the violence is violence against civilians, not just criminal violence and domestic violence, but violence by armed groups against civilians. And that tends not to get counted in these measures of civil war. So many of the areas that are called post-conflict, there's one database called ACLED, which is based on violent events, you can see that violence actually increases after the agreement. What is some kind of agreement is reached, and you're supposed to be post-conflict, but it doesn't actually reduce the violence. What I think post-conflict means is an agreement was made, which is the moment the international community feels it can deploy peacekeepers and other things. So what post-conflict means is not the end of conflict, it means the moment the conflict gets internationalized. So that's the first point I want to make. So if they don't end, I look at Afghanistan, it's been going on since 1978. I look at Syria, it's been going on since 2011. We can just go on and on and on. Libya, Congo, these things go on and on and on. So should we actually be calling them conflicts? Because what conflict implies is that there are two sides, a government and a rebel group, and we somehow can find a solution through a peace agreement. What I think happens is something, and I agree with you, conflict is transformation. It's a transformation of social relations into a new kind of social system that is reproduced through violence. That's what we're really looking at. And I haven't yet thought what we should call it. One colleague of mine says it's militarized neoliberalism. And that's not a bad description, because it usually happens in contexts where formerly authoritarian regimes open up under the pressure of neoliberalism. And you can see various characteristics that are extreme versions, but it's markets which are allocated by violence, if you like. But I think one can talk about various elements of this. So one element is that gaining access to the state or state power or local authority power has absolutely nothing to do with carrying out public services. It's all about getting access to state revenue. And state revenue by and large depends on minerals and aid from abroad and borrow. You don't need to worry about taxation. That's what it depends on. And so you want to gain, the state is the thing that gets the aid, so you want access to it. And you're ready to use violence and you're ready to compete and cooperate. So you find different groups competing, different groups in order to get access. And my colleague Alex de Waal calls this the political marketplace. That's one element. A second element is that, of course, you need a bit of politics, and the politics is generally some form of sectarianism, identity politics. So very characteristic. If you like, it's crony capitalism, which is very worrying when you think of this country. It's crony capitalism linked to ethnic nationalism. The crony capitalism is linked to neoliberalism because neoliberalism is all about contracting out the state, and one of the best ways to get access to state revenues is through getting a contract, to pull up a road or something, and then that's a huge source of extra money, and you give it to all your patronage networks. They all get the contracts once you get some sort of access to power. Usually it can be sectarianism, Shia, Sunni, it can be ethnic, as in the Balkans or in many parts of Africa, it can be religious. And the key thing about these ideologies is that they do depend on fear, and they're sustained through violence. So part of the game is, it's not just that you need violence to compete for power, you also need violence to keep your ideologies going. And these things don't necessarily work harmoniously. In fact, you know, once you get sectarianism going, you release passion, which makes it much more difficult to control your forces for patronage purposes. But nevertheless, these are all the ingredients. And then the final ingredient, I guess, is criminalization or a predatory economy. Because in these situations, I mean, you've already lost jobs from neoliberalism. Neoliberalism meant that you had extreme liberalization, that no longer agriculture was no longer profitable, people came into the towns, there weren't any jobs in the towns. So what do to live on? You form a criminal gang, you get humanitarian aid or whatever. And the great advantage of conflict situations is that law breaks down and it becomes completely acceptable. So what you see typically in every conflict I study is certain forms of criminal activity which are the dominant activities. So if you look at Syria, it's smuggling in oil and antiquities. If you look at Afghanistan, it's drugs. If you look at Colombia, it's drugs and oil, and so on and so forth. And so it's really difficult. I mean, this description I've given you applies to the Central American countries that aren't actually political. I mean, it applies to Venezuela, it applies to Mexico. So once you start thinking of it as a social system that keeps reproducing itself through violence, then thinking about peace has to be about changing the social system, I think. Now, this doesn't mean I'm against. I think the problem then becomes with peace building is that it's profoundly contradictory. On the one hand, it does make the situation a little bit less bad. If you reach a peace agreement, if there aren't overt clashes between armed groups. If you reach a peace agreement, it's only by telling the armed groups that they can have a position in government. So that's what happens. Most peace agreements legitimize the armed groups and they become political actors. Now, a good peace agreement, the best, is Bosnia, for example. That means that you don't actually fight each other and it's more difficult to legitimize your fighting against civilians. But so that the violence does go down, but at the same time, all the predatory activities continue and the sectarianism continues and there's an ever-present threat of return to war. Plus the fact that humanitarianism and the humanitarian aid, which since 1980 has become permanent, I mean, most of these states are permanently dependent on humanitarian aid, and humanitarian aid is meant to be an emergency aid, not a permanent feature. It's a permanent feature that actually feeds this whole war economy phenomenon. But of course, having said that, the fact that humanitarian aid exists means that a lot more people are kept alive. So it feeds into the system, it makes it less bad, but nevertheless, it makes peace even more remote. But before I end, I want to make one more point. We tend to think that peace is something that happens over there. These are globalized systems. They're systems that are totally integrated into global circuits. There's no way you could make money from antiquity and oil and drugs if there wasn't a huge market in Europe for antiquities, drugs, oil. So if we're trying to think of peace solutions, we need to start thinking of solutions at a global level. I mean, I've been trying to say, actually solving the problem of climate change could go a long way to helping us solve the problem of conflict, because if we reduced our expenditure on resources, then the opportunities for making money and getting revenue from resources would be much lower. So we might think in those positive sorts of terms. If we could deal with the drug problem, if we could legalize drugs, actually, I think that would have a miraculous effect on some conflicts, like Afghanistan. So we have to be thinking, and then organized crime. I mean, one of the reasons for the very huge boom in London property prices, and some of you may be aware of this, is that the London property market has turned out to be a fantastically good way of money laundering. So if you look at the most expensive houses in London, they belong to the crony capitalists we're talking, mostly Russian, admittedly, but quite a few Syrian warlords have nice houses. So, you know, so organized crime really feeds directly, and you could even argue it fed into Brexit, because the city is now making more and more money from, it really wants deregulation, so it can continue with this money, these money laundering activities. Sorry, this is rather an extreme accusation, but nevertheless, I'm making. So I just think we need to be looking at the global level. And so then there's a final question, well, am I being so pessimistic? I mean, are there ways? Well, what I think actually Richard does show, and Sierra Leone is a very nice example, that there are so many committed people in these peace-building situations that do actually understand a little bit more about what you have to do. And I have come across, and I think they would really like to shift in the ways that I'm suggesting, which is trying to build on, in all of these areas, it is a social system, they're very fragmented. You do find places where people are really trying to make change, and those are the areas that you really need support and international support. So one very nice example I found from Sierra Leone, I thought just because you, and actually now in Congo they're thinking of taking that up, is they decided to do demobilization on a communal basis. So instead of getting individual combat soldiers to give up their arms in exchange for money and training, which usually means they make money and go and buy more weapons, they said, we're only going to do it on a whole village basis. And the village gets a communal development project, provided they agree to give up all their weapons except hunting weapons, which have to be kept under the control of the sheikh or the imam or the clergyman, depending on their religion. And then when they'd done it, they had a ceremony, and they got this developed. I went to visit one where they decided to build a football pitch. In order to make money from having football games, and the local chief had given the land. So that was just a very nice example in Sierra Leone of where people had tried to think in a different way and tried to create local authorities, which is crucial that people trust. Now, these examples are very far between. I could talk a lot more, but I'm not going to for time reasons. But I think the point that I want to make is there are people in the UN and OSCE and EU peace-building communities that really understand a lot of that, and there are people at local levels. What is lacking is an understanding at the political level. And just a final point, if you don't think peace-building is good, look at Syria. Syria's where we've done absolutely nothing, and Syria is far the worst conflict that we've had with millions displaced, two-thirds of the population, hundreds of thousands of people killed. And that's because the only interventions have been military and not peace-building.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Okay, I think after Richard's talk, you understand what a big task it is actually to start to think about peace and to capture it, what it is about peace that makes it something that we recognize it as stable and something you want to have. But also, if you know post-conflict context, the point that Mary was making is that it looks like peace, but it doesn't really smell like peace. It doesn't like feel like peace when you live there, right? When all these if you like, ideologies and structures sort of just mutate and adjust, right, to a different context. So there's this idea of the continuum from war to peace. I wonder, Richard, if there is anything that you wanted to respond immediately, or if you...
I'll be very brief, yes, because I'd be very interested to hear questions and, for that matter, comments. from people in the audience. But Mary, I really like, I mean, the idea of your widening of a lens, I think, is extremely important. Taking a kind of social systems view of conflict. And I don't think it's in any way inconsistent with the approach. It's just that one has to be careful not to be too narrow in one's scope of analysis. And I think what you've done very helpfully is to identify factors which often aren't taken or not taken sufficiently into account when thinking about the dynamics of conflict, of violent conflict, the global context, the way in which conflict it penetrates across the globe, and the ways that violence is in some ways not really transcended, but transmuted, and it takes on different form. And I do mention in the book that, you know, there's also a lot of evidence that in so-called, I'm very careful about my use of this term, post-conflict, but where the overt violence on the battlefield has ended, there's evidence that a lot of the violence has turned inward, and there's a lot more domestic violence in the so-called post-conflict. So we have to be sensitive to the many different dimensions in which conflict, I think, can manifest itself. So I think that that's a very useful addition, if you will, a very useful emphasis to place. But as I said, I'd be very interested in reaction, question, and comment for that matter.
Okay, so I'll collect question and comments. Normally we say questions, but with your generosity, we will invite comments on this
Any
occasion.
Any comment can become a question.
And,
just to add.
I think both to Richard and Mary. Okay, so we have a question or comment here.
There is a very peculiar case of Sri Lanka where the military assaults ceased, wiping out the armed rebels. I can't say it is the end of war because another war started the following day, because the whole of the north was hyper-militarized, and according to the army websites, they started psychological operations. So psychological operations have been going on for the last more than 10 years, now nearly 11 years. But how can the UN, a peace building commission, give funding in the last 3 or 4 years, peace building funding, while this today the psychological operations are going on? Psychological operations means there has been no political solution, there has been no economic development after the war ended, or after the so-called war ended. It's only psychological operations of the army, highly funded army, giving presents to school children and very poor people. And this is 4 years into SDGs. There's no talk about SDGs. It's the only talk about army giving presents.
Okay, thank you. Yes, are there any other questions? Okay, we have a question here and a question there.
Hello, thank you so much for the talk. It was really interesting. My question is related to, because we were talking about some recommendations and principles that we should follow, but then let's imagine that we have the perfect tool to measure peace, right? When should we start measuring peace if we have some context? For instance, in Colombia, let's say, we have some communities in which the violence has ended, and therefore they can't wait until the entire country actually is in peace, at least negative peace, to start evaluating if they can coexist or if the peace has started. So when should we start measuring peace if there are some communities within the same country in which there's still a conflict or there's still war or violence, but there are other communities in which they have started, they have been pushed or obliged to start like coexisting in a way. So should we wait until the entire country is in peace, at least negative peace, to start measuring, or when should we start?
We have one question here and one over there.
Hi, thank you so much for such an insightful talk. My question has to do with maintaining stability of peace, particularly in terms of reconciling with the past. Operations of truth-finding commissions or reckoning with realities of what actually happened. While I understand that's extremely important to establishing peace, I also understand that it can affect how fragile peace is, particularly in a post-conflict society. So what is the role of truth and reckoning with the truth in this dialogue or process of peace?
Okay, and in this round we'll have one question.
Thank you for the talk, it's really interesting. I was just wondering, with your analysis of fieldwork operations, so when you're putting people on the ground, police officers, in certain locations, in certain regions, how do you assess their sensitivities or their ability to be sensitized towards human rights violations or things that are happening on the ground? How is that assessed, and how can you move forward with a framework that can adequately be used in multiple different states? I think it's a really good concept for an assessment point of view, but strategically, like, how could you thoroughly analyze whether or not somebody is sensitive to human rights conditions in certain regions, basically, when doing field work?
So, no easy questions. I was hoping there'd be easy questions. Let me maybe in reverse order. It's not easy, that's for certain. And just to stay with the example that you gave, there have been efforts, for instance, to monitor trials, to embed oneself with, say, police officers, or to observe police in action. And this has to be done over a period of time and across a region in order to be able to reach any general conclusions about the adequacy of this, say, judiciary or the police. Very subjective, obviously, as well. But I mean, if you look historically at some of the reporting, for instance, of the International Crisis Group on the health of the judiciary, I'm thinking about, again, in the region of former Yugoslavia, they were very, very good, I think, at identifying where progress had been made, where progress was lacking, and they did take the time very often to observe trials, but it takes enormous resources. I mean, you have to be conversant with the language. You have to be able to devote time to following a trial to its conclusion. You have to be able to observe how a judge behaves when maybe subjected to different pressures. If the judge is appearing before somebody of his or her own, let's say, ethnic group, is his or her engagement different to when it's a different ethnic group, for instance? So I can very much appreciate why there is a temptation to reach for what is much easier and, as I said, measurable. Also, given that these organizations are often under enormous pressure to report on and also to report progress. So training is a very easy thing, for instance, to achieve and to achieve well, in the sense that you can run a number of large numbers of people through programs and in that sense claim success. But you have to want to follow up. No, I understand. I appreciate that that is a structural problem.
I just want to add something. I mean, I think I'm completely in agreement with you. I actually think justice is at the heart. Building an independent and honest judiciary is the only way to deal with this kind of social system that where everybody is disobeying the law. You know, whether it's the laws of war, whether it's human rights laws, where it's everyday criminality, and the lack of justice systems is a huge problem. And I don't think nearly enough priority is given by the international community to justice. I felt that very, very strongly in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, every civil society group I ever met said they wanted more justice. And when you talk to the international community about supporting civil society, they all said, oh, we give them all this money and everything. And, you know, if you say, but the one thing they want is support for justice systems, they don't get it. And that's because they think peace comes before justice and making deals with criminals comes before justice. Whereas I think if you make deals with criminals, you can't solve the problem of the conflict. So that's why I'd say, but I just wanted to tell you one thing we're doing in our research program, and I do wonder whether it couldn't be replicated. We actually decided as a research method to train paralegals to monitor courts, and we're doing it in both South Sudan and Somalia. And it was mainly as a research tool, because then we get the court reports, and we can report on, we can do research on the cases, but actually it actually has helped to increase the transparency and to make the judges think a little bit about what they're doing. And there's a wonderful book by Rachel Ebreck, who started this whole project, on law and activism in South Sudan, which will tell you a lot about this project, and we've now extended it to Kismayo in Somalia. And I think if we could do more of that kind, because having local paralegals is a really good way of approaching it.
And could I add, consistent, we haven't talked at all about another important component, I think, in building peace, and that is a free and independent media and responsible media. Mm. So the role that the media can play, for instance, in covering trials and reporting fairly, it's very difficult, but there are organizations, I sit on the board of one of them, that attempts to impart the skills and standards that are required, and that every society, I mean, look, even in the West today, look at the United States and the absolutely critical role that the media have played in shining light on the abuse of power in the case of the United States. So I think that it goes hand in hand with genuine, if you will, capacity training. I mean, because this can't be a responsibility that is the responsibility of internationals, of externals, although they do have a role to play. And I mentioned International Crisis Group as an example. But it has to be a capacity that's developed within these countries as well, many of whom haven't had much experience, and so it's very new to them, because if it's been years of authoritarian rule, there hasn't been a place for a free, responsible, independent media. But I think that they can also contribute to supporting. We'll maybe come back if we have time. I don't want to be taking your role, but I know that there were other other questions. I think the question about reconciling with the past, the role of truth, is very closely related to what we've just been talking about, because very often the truth emerges from the conduct of a fair trial. But there are many other ways in which the truth, if you will, is revealed, and let us not forget that the truth itself is something that is also contested, and there will be different interpretations of the so-called truth. But I defer here to experts who have worked on transitional justice, and this is certainly one of them, to generalize about the kind of truth telling, truth seeking, the timing of this. What I can say is that we often think that this may not be important, or it may be too traumatic, and maybe it is at a given time in history. But as we've seen with so many societies, Spain, just one example close to home, the truth that is buried is often not satisfactory, and it leaves a lot of conflict unresolved. And the idea that you can submerge it and ignore it, it can also come back to haunt. I mean, we're seeing even now again also in Chile, the return, if you will, of the abuses of Pinochet have never been fully revealed, and we're living with the consequences of a failure to come to a reckoning with the past. But it has to be done with great care. I don't have expertise in this area, and you might want to add something, Denise, but I'm not trying to suggest that there's one approach that works for all conflict situations, but I think it is a very important factor in trying to achieve a stable peace in eliminating at least, or mitigating one very important contributing factor to conflict in society. If you want to add anything.
I would, but I'm just conscious of the time.
I'll be very quick with the other two questions.
Yes, I think that question on a micro-comparative perspective, where you have some areas which...
Well, one thing it tells us, and it's a very... thank you for the question, because...
In Syria, weren't you studying civility within conflict as well? So maybe I think both of you could speak to that question.
You want to first?
Well, I'm not sure that Colombia isn't a little bit different, in the sense that one of the problems, I think, in Colombia is that peace comes to the major cities and then violence erupts in the periphery and nobody much cares about it, and I think that's a huge problem. I think the question that you were asking, which I think is really important, and this is what we, in my research program, very much focus on, is that there always are areas that where local people just try to keep out of the conflict and do all kinds of things to preserve the legitimacy of their work together, to preserve the peace in their particular areas. I mean, if you take a place, Hama, where in the early 80s, the former Assad killed some 10,000 people when they were determined not to have a return to war. And so basically they made a peace deal at the beginning of the war. There were 10 brothers, 9 of whom were businessmen, and 1 was a sheikh who was linked to the opposition. And they made a deal with both the opposition and the government to keep out of their town, and their town was safe. Or another case, which I really like, and which Saskia Sassoon and I call the yogurt run, is, I don't know if you've heard of El Ghouta, which is a suburb of Damascus, where the most horrible violence has taken place. It's where the chemical weapons attacks took place. So there's a dairy farmer in Al Ghouta who supplies most of the yogurt to Damascus. So he made a deal with the government not to bomb his dairy farm. And it became a little safe haven inside Ghouta where many displaced people collected. And we found something like 400 of these types of local peace agreements.
Yes. I mean, that was a strategy that was...
And, you know, one could develop a completely different strategy. I mean, some of them are just armed groups. And also, I think, a place like Syria is interesting because it's fairly advanced. So you need electricity, you need oil, you need clean water, and you need technicians who can do it. And so actually technicians play an incredibly important role in negotiating these kinds of deals in order to mend the water pipes or whatever it is. And that gives them a degree of local legitimacy that enables them, it gives them leverage. So I do think it's very interesting. But, you know, there are lots of sort of examples where armed groups have just made local deals because they need something. I mean, not all the examples, or there have been surrenders. So they're not all positive. Not all these 400 are, if you like, civil examples. But nevertheless, I think if the international community took these as seriously, took what was happening on the ground as seriously as reaching some esoteric political deal, that would make a big difference.
But just to comment specifically on Colombia, I mean, I think it demonstrates that peace and conflict, violent conflict, are uneven. I mean, and that's why in any given conflict-affected country, the dynamics won't be the same across the country. And I think it's never too early, as part of understanding what the dynamics of conflict and peacemaking, peace-building are, to be sensitive to what's going on and for what reasons.
Mind you, the Colombian peace agreement did include this notion of territorial peace, which was quite interesting compared with any other piece. Anyway, sorry.
But I think, I mean, even if you take the Democratic Republic of Congo, for instance, I mean, the conflict dynamics there are not the same throughout the country. And there are often areas that are not affected, or at least not affected as severely by violent conflict. So, I mean, it does raise questions about how bespoke, let's say, an approach might be, and whether one needs to address the one region or community and the violence in that area differently. But I think it is important not to assume. Again, it's the idea of one approach fits all, one size fits all. And then just last to acknowledge, Sri Lanka is a testament to the failure, obviously, of efforts, determined though they were, especially by the Norwegian government, to try to achieve a mediated, negotiated solution that would have avoided, if they had been successful, the bloodbath which took place. And you know, we can reflect on why that was the case, despite, as I said, their very, very committed, determined effort to bring peace to the region. Obviously, it doesn't always succeed, and this was a case where one party to the conflict was determined that it was going to vanquish totally the opposition and to eliminate them effectively.
So thank you so much. I think given the time, we should. But just to say, this has been a second debate that we've had this year on peace, and it just strikes me that, you know, we need to have another one soon. So watch this space. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Mary, and thank you all for coming and for your questions that prompted this lovely and interesting discussion after the presentations. Watch for our events, and I hope you come again to continue the discussion. Thank you.
You.